All right, good to see you all. Yeah, that's too loud even for me.
I do the same thing.
It's good to see you all. It's good to be back. And we are continuing our class on the visions of God. And we finished the book of Ezekiel last time. And we are starting right in the book of Daniel. And I realized that a little more than five years ago, it was the summer that Jim came to be with us. I taught a class on the book of Daniel here. And then we did 1st and 2nd Peter, and then you came right when we finished in 2nd Peter. But granted, it's been 5 years. I don't know how much you all remember. But this is very much in context of our class on visions of God. Daniel, of course, is full of visions and dreams, just like Ezekiel was full of visions and dreams. And we're going to cover chapter 1 and 2 today. The interesting thing about Daniel, as opposed to Ezekiel, is Daniel's much more well known. At least a couple of parts of Daniel. What are the parts of the book of Daniel that everybody knows?
The lion's den.
Daniel and the lion's den. What about the other one?
We were talking about the fire.
Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, right? And the reason for that is we're all told that from the time we're little bitty.
And that's all we're told.
Yeah, unfortunately. That's all we're told. We're going to cover those things, but we're going to cover the vast majority of the book of Daniel is dreams and visions. And Daniel is probably, outside of the book of Revelation, the most commented on and most disputed book in the Bible. And the reason is it has a lot to say about the future, at least the future at the time Daniel was told. And so lots of people want to interpret it all kinds of crazy ways, and we're going to talk about that today. Now, little historical context. Daniel was a contemporary of Ezekiel. They lived in the same time period. If you remember, I accessed my internet database of biblical dates, jimhobbs.com, and he gave me this. So, the first, you know, Ezekiel was taken to Babylon in the second invasion of Jerusalem. 597, 586 was when the temple was destroyed. All of that's what we've been talking about in Ezekiel for the last like 9 months. Okay? Was that time period. Right here in the middle. Daniel and his fellows were taken away to Babylon in 606. This was the first time that Nebuchadnezzar came and laid siege to the city, and we're going to hear about that context here in chapter 1. And so Daniel and Ezekiel lived in the same time period. They were both captives of the nation of Babylon. They were both effectively prisoners. And they had very different lives. Remember, Ezekiel lived with the captives by the river Kibar in Babylon. He was a priest and a prophet. And he spent a lot of time laying on his side, didn't he? Years. And months and months and months. And having really wild dreams. And telling people, God's going to have to destroy his temple. He's going to have to destroy it. He's going to do it. It's done. It's finished. Now let's move on. And God's going to protect the remnant. God's going to bring them back. Daniel's a completely different set of topics. Daniel doesn't really talk about, except just slightly in some of the visions, anything about the children of Israel. Almost everything he talks about in this book is about the nations around. Nations and kingdoms. And we're going to hear this in the first chapter. It's going to be very clear. Actually, the second chapter. Why this whole book is written. And the big lesson we get out of it. The big lesson we get out of it is really plain. So let's start off by reading Daniel chapter 1 just for context, because this talks about how Daniel and his fellows got there and leads up to chapter 2, which is the first dream. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel, and some of the king's descendants, and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now from among the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over David, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants 10 days and give those vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away the portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. As for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. Okay, so here he is. Young men, teenagers, most likely, brought with the captivity. Remember, they just didn't walk up to Jerusalem and knock on the door and say, okay, we're here, everybody, come on. Give me your treasures from the temple and give me your young men, we're leaving. This was after a siege. Okay, it had been, and we know from reading scriptural accounts of sieges, this was terrible. You know, they kept the siege on. They would attack constantly, and they would not let any food or water come in. And the people would basically starve. They basically starve them out. That's basically what you do with a siege, is you starve the people out, either starvation or disease. And so it was a pretty rough situation. But notice, who was in control of the siege? Notice the very first verse, or actually the second verse. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, along with some of the articles of the house of God. The Lord gave the king of Judah into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. That's a hint. Now, notice some of the articles of the house of God. He didn't take all the treasures. He took some. This is important later on when Daniel... The other story that everybody learns has to do with a handwriting on the wall, right? The reason that happened was that the king at that time, Belshazzar, went and got these articles from the temple and gave to all of his nobles, and they were all getting drunk, drinking wine. That's when the hand appeared. So this is all connected, okay? Now, okay, so he brings these young men, he assigns them to the chief of the eunuchs. This may or may not imply that they were made eunuchs. It's possible, but we don't know. We know we don't have any record of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, or Azariah having wives and families, so it's possible, but we don't know. And set them to training for 3 years. And there was this whole thing about feeding them, you know, and Daniel said, I don't want to eat that stuff, that's unclean. Just feed us vegetables and water. They turned out to be better. You know, what this shows is that Daniel was a wise young man. And he was an impressive young man. You notice what it says, God had brought the chief of the eunuchs to be favorably disposed to Daniel. You see, God's in control. He's setting up Daniel for this purpose. And in fact, for all the horror that went on in the siege of Jerusalem, and the overthrow of it, and marching these guys away, they didn't take them in an air-conditioned cab, folks. You know, a lot of times it meant marching naked with hooks through your nose for hundreds of miles. I don't know what they did here. It doesn't say. But, you know, this was a horrible event.
You mentioned the fact that they may have been teenagers, and that's a good possibility because they didn't want the sick and infirm. They wanted the young and the healthy.
Young and healthy and smart.
Yes.
And it says noble. He was looking for people who could be managers and rulers in his kingdom. He was looking to pull the brains out of the people of Israel and make them in his kingdom. And that's eventually what he does. It says what he does. He trains them for 3 years, teaches them the language, you know, the Babylonian language, the Chaldean language, and teaches them all their literature and science and everything. And then they come before the king, and the king asks them a bunch of questions. They have their oral exams, you know, like we talk about with a PhD or something. Right, they get up and they get discussed, they get questioned, and it turns out these guys are pretty smart. And so the king sets them in, you know, he gives them jobs in Babylon. So that was his normal plan. He did it with the rest of the guys too that were taken. It wasn't just these three guys or four guys. Now, let's go to chapter 2. Notice who he was compared with. Chapter 1. All the magicians and astrologers. Keep that in mind. Okay, chapter 2. Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. Then the king gave command to all the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king, and the king said to them, "I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to know the dream." Then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation." And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you will be cut in pieces and your houses will be made an ash heap. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation." They answered again and said, "Let the king tell the servants the dream, and we will give its interpretation." And the king answered and said, "I know for certain that you would gain time because you see that my decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time is changed. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation." The Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean. It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." For this reason the king was angry and very furious, and he gave command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree from the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the decision known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and that they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning this secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven, and Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are His, and He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with Him. I thank You and praise You, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we have asked of You, for You have made known to us the king's dream." Now, I'm going to stop right there for a second. So, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Really bugs him. He calls what? All the magicians, astrologers, soothsayers, and Chaldeans. Chaldea is the name of the Babylonian region. A Chaldean is somebody from Babylon. But in the term that we, when we see the term used, the Chaldeans, it means the wise men. The wise men of Babylon. So, you know, these were, and whenever it says, go call the Chaldeans, he's not saying just any old guy who happens to be a citizen of Babylon. He's talking about the wise men. So the king gathers all of his wise men and says, "I've had a dream." And they say, "Great. We like interpreting dreams. Tell us the dream. And we'll all take our best shot at it." The king says, "Huh? You got to tell me the dream too. Now, how do they react?
Can't do that.
My man can do that.
Now, the first thing they do is say, oh, come on, King, tell us the dream. Right? So you just go ahead and tell us the dream. They say it again, right? Tell us the dream. And we'll tell the interpretation.
But they were the same guys that presented themselves as having some kind of special, magical, mystical knowledge.
Yeah, isn't that the case? And that's why I drew all this stuff on the board here. I have a crystal ball, I have a bunch of zodiac symbols, and I have a magic book of spells drawn on the board here. Now, notice what they say. They say, King, after he says the second time, look, I know you're just wanting to lie to me. You're just wanting to buy time. If you don't tell me the dream, I'm going to cut you in pieces and make your houses into an ash heap. By the way, that's his standard punishment. We're going to hear that several times in the book of Daniel. And in the ash heap doesn't quite capture the smell of this. The King James is dunghill. Okay? It basically means the place where you're going to dump all of your garbage and all of your sewage. So this is pretty awful. This isn't just a place where they sweep the ashes out of the furnace, okay? So he says, I'm going to take your whole house, and I'm going to cut you all up, and I'm going to make it into a sewage dump. Now, how do they respond? King, nobody's ever asked in. Nobody can do this. And notice who they were. The astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers, the wise men. King, nobody can do this. No one on earth can do this. Only the gods can do this. By their own mouth, what did they just say?
Testified against themselves.
Yeah, they're liars. Now, how many people today, you know, we were driving, Sarah and I went to the Cleveland County Fair, and right along the road down there, 74, there's a psychic, right? You know, little psychic house. You ever notice the people who have those little, they're always little bitty houses kind of run down? You know, if they could really predict the future, don't you think they'd live in a better place? You know, just kind of one of those things that you might want to ask them sometime. Well, so I was reading a commentary by Jim McGuigan on Daniel. It's an excellent commentary. And he raised this point. He said, why do they always have to have a crystal ball? If the crystal ball does anything, why don't we just go buy our own crystal ball? Why do we need the middleman? I mean, this is all really good stuff, right? Why do they need this stuff? Now, the astrologers do what? What do astrologers do? They look at the arrangement of the stars and the planets. And they use that via some mumbo-jumbo to try to predict the future. We see them all the time. They're called horoscopes. They're in the paper every day. Right? Now, so they're looking at the stars trying to predict the future. These people are gazing into crystal balls. What about magicians? We've had a real run of that the last 10 or 15 years in the U.S. because of the popularity of the Harry Potter books. Everybody got all excited. There's all kinds of shows, movies, and sitcoms, you know, various kinds of shows of people all with all these magical powers. You know, and they've all got little secret spells and all that kind of stuff. By the way, what does the Bible say about people who do that kind of stuff?
They kill them.
Yeah.
In the Old Testament, but it's still condemned in the New Testament.
Yeah. But if you ran into a witch or wizard in the Old Testament, what were you supposed to do? He said, cut them off. Kill them. If you ever want to get a validation of that from someone who practiced that, go read about Saul and the Witch of Endor. The thing is,
when somebody goes to that person is setting himself or herself up equal with God. Got knowledge that only God has.
Yep. Now, So this is what we've gotten to this point. So the king says, all right, off with all of your heads. Now, either Nebuchadnezzar was a pretty flighty character, or he had experience with these people and knew that they really couldn't say much. But he decides he's going to kill them all. And so the captain of the guard comes, and he's out looking. He's starting to kill them, and he's running around and finding them. He finds Daniel. Daniel says, hold on, Arioch, what's the deal? And he says, the king is, you know, he explains the situation. And Daniel says, hang on a second, let me go talk to the king. Now, he goes in and does it. He comes back. He prays. Notice how he goes about it. He doesn't go, hey, I got this. I'm a smart guy. I know how to do this. Take me into the king. He says, give me time and let me pray. And he brings his brothers together and they pray. And they pray and God answers them, it says. And notice what the first thing out of his mouth is. Praise to God. Thank you, Father. for glory and might and wisdom are yours. This is one thing about Daniel. Daniel never, ever, ever takes any glory for himself for all the mighty things that he does. Okay, now, 24. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, the king whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went in and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation." Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, "I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known the king the interpretation." The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?" Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, "The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, magicians, and soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions on your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, your thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and he who reveals secrets have made known to you what it will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. And this image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. And the image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, and its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while the stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried it away, so no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now, we will tell you the interpretation of it before the king. You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hands, and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall rise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. And the fourth kingdom will be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like the iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes partly of clay and partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. And the king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him a ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So there's the story. So Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And in his dream, he sees this great image, this great idol, and it's made of metal. It says it has a head of gold, it has the arms and chest of silver, it has the belly and thighs of bronze, and the iron, the legs of iron, and the feet of iron mixed with clay. That's what he sees. And then he sees a rock cut out of a mountain without hands. So here comes the rock, right? The rock comes flying in and strikes on the feet. And the whole thing goes to pieces. And then the rock grows into a great mountain that fills the whole earth. That's the dream. Now, when Daniel explains this, the first thing he says is, "This ain't my wisdom. This is coming directly from God. It's not given to me because I'm wiser or smarter than anybody. It's given to you, O king, because you need to know." Now, do you notice what Daniel says when he says that? Notice. He raises up kings and he takes down kings. That's the key to the book. The big chunk of the book is all about kingdoms rising and kingdoms falling. Not all of it, but a large part of it. And the big message in the whole book of Daniel is God is in control. Period. End of statement. No exceptions. God is in control. Is he in control of the Jews? Yep. Is he in control of the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Greeks, the Medo-Persians? The Japanese, the Germans, ISIS, the Russians, the Americans, the British? Yeah. Hitler? Yes. Yes, God is in control. Now, we don't understand how he does it and why he does it. We know he does it. This is what he says. He raises up kings and he takes down kings. Who's he talking to? Is Nebuchadnezzar a faithful king? Is he a believer in God? Well, he was a little bit of a believer after his dream was told, but before, what was he doing? He's pagan. In fact, as far as we know, he saved pagan. Now, he acknowledged God at the end of this, but we're going to find out in just the next chapter, he decides to build an idol and make everybody bow down to it. You know, so he's not a convert. But look at what he does. Look at this thing. So he says, here's your dream. By now, you imagine that Nebuchadnezzar's pretty stunned. Because not only is Daniel reading his mind, he's reading his mind in the past. It's a pretty fascinating thought, right? There are a lot of people today that talk about reading people's minds, right? They can't. But he's reading it in the past. And this is only something God can do. So, he says, here's the image. So here's this image, this great, fearsome idol. Precious, it starts with fine gold, silver, bronze, and iron. So what's the first thing you realize about the metals? They have different value, don't they? Gold is by far the most valuable, the most precious, the most glorious. Silver is next. Bronze is kind of utilitarian. Right? It's strong. Iron is even stronger. But not as precious. So you get this kind of picture of what's going on. And then Daniel explains. He says, okay, you are that head of gold. So here we go. Nebuchadnezzar. You are that head of gold. And after you, another kingdom will arise that's not as precious as yours. Not as great as yours. And after them, another kingdom will arise. And after them, another kingdom will arise. So what's he saying these things are? Kingdoms. Right? He says, here's your kingdom. Here's another kingdom. Here's another kingdom. And another kingdom. So he's making this very plain. He's telling us what it is. Now, nobody argues that these are kingdoms in their interpretation. What people want to argue is which kingdom is he talking about? The whole book of Daniel talks about these time periods. Basically, the scope of the time of the book of Daniel goes from Nebuchadnezzar, where Daniel is right now, down to and through the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. That's basically the time period. It's the rest of the history of the nation of Israel. Okay? Now, people want to argue that. They want to argue that for the reason. What's a stone? Cut out of a mountain without hands. Where have we heard that before? Who makes things without hands? God does. God does things. Men make things with hands. God does things without hands. This grows into a great mountain that fills the whole earth. And what does it say about that kingdom? These kingdoms fall, don't they? They're made by men and they fall. What happens to that kingdom?
It's an everlasting kingdom that shall never fail.
Never fall and never be given to another people. That's another clue. It's not a national thing that's going to rise and fall and rise and fall as kings come and go. It's an eternal kingdom. So you've got all these kingdoms that are led by men, national kingdoms, empires of earth, and then you have this eternal kingdom here that's coming. Well, you know, looking back from our perspective, what's that eternal kingdom?
Heaven?
The church?
Very good questions. Now, first of all, what did I say the key was of the whole book of Daniel? The one big lesson of the whole book of Daniel, what is it?
God is in charge.
God is in control. Has there ever been a time since the creation that God was not in control? Nope. So who's actually the king of all creation? God. Okay? That doesn't change. That doesn't change. God's still in control. He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords. It doesn't matter who's on the throne. It doesn't matter what time period you're talking about. Now, do we have verses in the scripture that talk about Jesus receiving a kingdom and the church being a kingdom? Right? Yes. Is that the same as we're talking about when we say God is in control of all the earth? No. Not the same exactly. It's a subset of it. Right? So, let's keep all that in mind. But here he says, man's kingdom falls, man's kingdom falls, man's kingdom falls, man's kingdom falls. God's kingdom is eternal. And it's going to start with a stone made out of hands. It's going to strike at this point in the foot. And it's going to grow into a whole mountain, fill the earth, and it's going to be eternal. So if you can figure out what that is, you know when this eternal kingdom is going to come, right? And this is the whole reason people get all, you know, interested in Daniel. So, we know one thing for sure because he says it directly in this vision. Babylon is the first kingdom. Then it says, after you, another will come. Now, what we're going to see in Daniel, there's a bunch of different visions and dreams in Daniel. Daniel has several visions, and each one of these visions talk about different aspects of the time period being discussed here. These are all in time, right? This kingdom's now, after you, this kingdom's going to happen, after that, after that. One of his dreams talks about a ram and a he-goat. And it says expressly what those are. He says, the ram is Medo-Persia and the goat is Greece. It says, that's what it is. And he's talking about two kingdoms and how it's going to be a transfer from the kingdom of the ram, Medo-Persia, and the kingdom of the goat, which is Greece. And then he talks a lot about a very long, detailed vision that Gabriel explains to him that goes into this long discussion of the king of the north will come to the king of the south and do this, and they'll go over here and they'll go do this, and they'll have this battle, and the man, this one will marry this one, and this will do on, and it goes on and on and on. And then eventually, all those kingdoms are overthrown. And you get to these guys, which is basically Rome. Now, I can show you, we will show you the study of this. And what we're talking about here is this is the Medo-Persian Empire. And that comes right after the Babylonian. In fact, it happens in Daniel. Jim talked about this the other day. Afterwards, we have the Greek Empire. After that, we have the Roman Empire. And what happens during the Roman Empire? Jesus is born and dies and is resurrected, and the eternal kingdom happens. Now, people want to argue because, you see, there's a problem. You remember Wednesday night when y'all were talking about the various beliefs that came about? One of the things that we generally call them premillennialists, but basically people who believe in a thousand-year reign, a literal thousand-year reign on earth, one of the things they believe is that God's kingdom, Jesus' kingdom, hasn't happened yet. And it's going to wait until he comes back to earth and sets it up. That's what they teach. The problem is, if they look at this king, if they look at this dream, and they look at the interpretation, and they say, this is Rome, they have kind of a problem saying it hadn't happened for 2,000 years since Rome. And so they try to say, well, let's see, the legs of iron were Rome, but the toes down here are a bunch of kingdoms that are going to rise that are going to be sort of like Rome 2,000 years later, still in the future. That's what they argue. You read their books. This is what they talk about. Other people don't want to make that Rome at all. They want to take the Medes and the Persians as separate ones and make Greek the final one. The problem, of course, with that is then you're saying during the Greek Empire, pre-Rome, the eternal kingdom is set up with the Messiah. That doesn't make sense either historically. So, you know, there's lots of people that try to mix this up. But when you look at it, especially when you look at the rest of the book, and we'll look at it, this is what really comes out clear. You got Babylon, much more glorious empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, the Greek, and in fact we're going to find here, really takes off with Alexander the Great, and then turns after Alexander dies, his four generals divide up the kingdom. We're going to see that in these visions. And And then they had the Ptolemy and Seleucid Empire, which fights over Palestine for hundreds of years. And eventually the Romans come in and take over. And then at the bottom here, where it says, what about this thing, the feet is part of iron and part of clay? Now what do we know about iron and clay? It says it. We just read it. Yeah, it doesn't mix. It doesn't mix. Now, have you not seen, you can go out here, if you went out here and dug up, took a jackhammer to our parking lot out here, what would you find down inside the concrete? You'd find rebar, wouldn't you? You'd find iron. It can strengthen it, but it's partly brittle too, because you can take a jackhammer to it. If that was solid iron, jackhammer wouldn't do you any good. So this is kind of what's going on. He talks about the clay and the iron mixed together. He says, well, part of it's brittle, but part of it's still strong. Now, if this is historical, which it is, I mean, you know, God says it's historical. He says these are going to be a bunch of kingdoms that happen in order. He says, at some point, the strength of this empire, I'm going to say it's Rome, is going to be weakened. And it's going to be weakened, why? It says, because they will mingle with the seed of men. Wonder what that means. He's talking about a kingdom. By the way, are these national groups? Even racial groups? The Babylonians were Babylonians, right? The Medes and the Persians were Medes and Persians, living in modern-day Iran, right? The Greeks were Greeks. The Romans were Romans. But what did the Romans do? And notice what it said, that it broke down, it conquered everybody. What did the Romans do? From a national point of view, did they kind of hang out in Italy and just kind of take care of business? No, they went all over the place. They went all over Africa. They went all over the Middle East. They went all over Europe, conquering everywhere. What did they do with the people they conquered? They enslaved them, right?
They went into Europe, Great Britain.
All over.
One of the efforts to discredit the Roman Empire is verse 42, which says, in the days of these kings, God will set up this kingdom. These kings being the fourth kingdom, the fourth empire. But they say, well, the Roman Empire didn't have kings. They just had one emperor, ruler over it. But you just pointed out that Rome went everywhere and they set up these kings or these...
They had client kings. We call them client kings, basically. Right. Like King Agrippa.
Right.
So who was King Agrippa? Or King Herod, for that matter. Were they completely sovereign rulers over the Middle East? Over Palestine? In complete control? Not owing anything to anybody? No, they were client kings. They had to bow to Caesar. Now, we'll also find out later, Daniel's got a bunch of this stuff. We're going to spend quite a bit of time in it because these dreams are very detailed. And the language of Daniel, much like some of the language of Ezekiel, is reflected almost word for word in a lot of the parts of the book of Revelation. So in our whole quest to understand dreams and visions and figurative language, this is really important for us to understand. Later on, he talks about a dream where the four beasts come up out of the earth, out of the sea, and the terrible beast, and the beast basically fit the same model as the four parts of the image. The last beast is great and terrible, and it stomps and conquers all the other beasts, much like, you know, this one conquers all the rest. And then it says, and it has 10 horns. And then the interpretation says the 10 horns are 10 kings. And this is the interpretation that the angel gives Daniel, when Daniel says, what does this mean? So, you know, there are kings involved here, and these nations have kings or rulers over them. Now, let's see what else we got here. We have, I want to give you a little bit of a preview here, because it's important to understand the structure of the book of Daniel. Now in Daniel you have this dream, and then you have the fiery furnace episode, which isn't really about dreams, although a very interesting character shows up in the fire with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Extra points, as I said all the way through Ezekiel, if you learn their Hebrew names as well, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Okay? You'll need that on a Bible bowl question someday. So you got that, and then you have this other dream. Nebuchadnezzar has another dream, and he dreams of this tree. great tree that gets cut down, and he gets the interpretation that he's basically the tree, and this is what's going to happen to him until he acknowledges that God's in control. And then you have Belshazzar's feast, you know, the handwriting on the wall, meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin. Then you have Daniel talking about some of his dreams. He has a number of dreams. He has a dream where he talks about this change of kingdoms. He talks about the ram. And he talks about the goat. Then it talks about the goat has four. One, it had one notable horn, and then the horn was broken off. But then it has four horns. Those are the four generals of Alexander the Great. Then it goes into this discussion about all the kingdoms and all the things that are going on, the king of the north, the king of the south, on and on and on. My daughter Sarah actually did a really nice paper study, historical paper, on mapping all of those events to what we know about history. And I'll share some of that with you at some point. It maps up almost exactly all the way through. You're going to hear about another dream where it talks about a lion with eagle's wings who's given a heart of man. It's talking about a bear that hikes up on one side and has three ribs in its mouth. It talks about a leopard that has four wings. And then it talks about a great monster with great teeth of iron that breaks everything up and stamps them to pieces. Well, these things map directly to what he's talking about here. These are the same stories. Each one of these things, we get a different perspective of what's going on. When you see some of this, you're going to see in the ram has two horns, and one of them, they came up at different times, and the first horn is not as big as the second horn. Over here with the bear, it says that the bear was hiked up on one side. It says plainly that the ram and the goat, that this is Medo-Persian, right? The leopard, the image of the leopard is one of swiftness. It says it moved really fast, and it has four wings. And then it says it has four heads. You know, Alexander the Great was well known for the speed at which he conquered. You know, he was in his mid-20s when he died. And he had already conquered the known world. And then when it gets to this great monster, it talks about what happens to it at the end. So all of these discussions that we're going to see in these visions, they're talking about a historical perspective of what's happening from Daniel's time here with Nebuchadnezzar all the way down to basically the end of the Roman Empire, or at least the end of it from the standpoint of when the next kingdom comes on the scene. And that's what you're going to see. So it zooms in. This is the thing that to look at. Here we have the big picture, the whole big picture of time. And then he's going to zoom in on this part right here, between the Medes and the Greeks. Then he's going to zoom in on the Greeks and what's going on in the Greeks. And then you get to chapter 9 and you get to what's called the 70 weeks prophecy. And here things get really interesting, because now it starts giving a timetable. And it says 70 weeks have been ordained until the indignation is finished, and basically, because Daniel asks a question, he says, what's going to happen to my people? God comes back and says, here's what's going to happen to your people. He lays out a calendar. He says, here's what's going to happen. And it goes all the way up to the destruction of Jerusalem and the birth of the Messiah, by the way, prior to that. So, you know, it's a very historical book. It's a very prophetic book. Almost everything that he's talking about here is stuff happening in the future from when he said it. And one really important point, toward the end of the book, and Daniel's trying to ask more questions. And the angel tells him, seal up the book, for it's a long time from now. These things are a long time off. Seal it up. Go your way, Daniel. You'll rest with your fathers. Stuff's for a long time off. You know how long this was? Where are we at? We're right about in here when this is happening. 600 BC, roughly in that range. BC counts backwards. How many years from 600 BC to Christ? 600, right? So we're talking about basically up to 70 AD up here. You're basically talking about by the time he gets down into this, almost everything had happened in this thing by 400 or 500 years after Daniel says it. But yet he was told to seal it up because it was a long way off. The important difference to think about as we go through this, because this is a very prophetic book, is in the book of Revelation, what does it say? Seal not the book, for the time is at hand. Fascinating thing to think about. We'll stop there.